Hey, everybody, welcome to another exciting, scintillating, and fascinating episode of the OIG Roundtable. I am, of course, joined by my two partners in crime, Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent charged in the LA field office, now manager on our SOU investigative team, and Matt Kachansky, the retired special agent charged from the OIG and the retired Northeast UPIC director, and senior director of our payment integrity team. And obviously, you two guys are in chilly land because Wade's already got his hoodie on, and it's apparently chilly. And Matt, we already know that your wife doesn't allow you to turn the heat up beyond 65 degrees. And so as a result of that, you have to wear a little bit of a sweatshirt as well.
Sort of like, you know, Bob Cratchit and Ebenezer Scrooge, you know, can I have another piece of coal, sir?
Yeah, no, I get it. I get it. I get it. Sorry.
These are the Elvis Costello, huh?
These are the things. Oh, yeah.
Concert swag.
Great. We're going to pump it up. Phenomenal. So today, by the way, Friday, the 24th, is the release of the Bruce Springsteen movie. I have not watched any trailers or anything. I do have tickets. I'm going with a group of about 10 or 15 people to go and see this movie. I have only seen very small 5-second snippets, so I'm very excited to go see this. It is about the making of what he considers to be his best record, Nebraska. I don't know if I think it's his best record, but it's what he thinks is his best record. So maybe I'll give a review next week. That'll be the OIG Roundtable. We'll be like the Siskel, Ebert, and Ebert secret ballots. But today we have an important topic to talk about, and that's a topic that SIUs have to deal with on a daily basis. It hits the ROI, and it is settlement negotiations. Settlement negotiations are probably one of the key components that an SIU will go through because it is the resolution of a case once that case is no longer in dispute. And again, you know, when we talk about cases, and I think we've seen this to be endemic in the SIU world, is that once an investigator completes their investigation and issues their overpayment letter, SIU investigators tend to wash their hands and move on to the next thing. And in some instances, that may be true. But until you get a check, or until the case is resolved in that sense, the case is ongoing, right? There's going to be appeals. There's going to be arbitration. There's a whole host of things that are going to happen, particularly if the case results in a referral to law enforcement or a regulatory agency. There are many other pieces of the puzzle. So please, SIU investigators, please, please, please do not think that merely because you've completed your investigation, completed it, and have issued an overpayment letter, that your job is done. That may just be the beginning. And that's why we tell you that when you're going through this investigation, you always need to be thinking in terms of litigation and litigation strategy and the importance of documenting and all of that. So, but when we do get to a point where the provider calls up and says, I need to settle this and I need to resolve this, right? Your overpayment letter is going to be the full amount that you as the investigator have identified as being the overpayment. Whether it be an actual overpayment, meaning a claim by claim from a probe sample, because anytime you're doing claim by claim, that's probe, or you're doing an extrapolation off of a statistically valid random sample, you're going to have an overpayment amount, and you're going to have to be able to negotiate that and get that resolved. So wait, I want to start because this is, you know, obviously at the OIG, we didn't really do a lot of this. We didn't really get involved with settlement negotiations. That was between the U.S. Attorney's Office, and settlement negotiations could have even been with a criminal component, a civil component, or with Office of Counsel to the Inspector General when it was relative to an administrative case. So, you know, obviously you retire in 2017, you come here, you've been on our team now for a number of years. Settlement negotiations are unique because it's something that you have to kind of learn and get trained on. But, you know, I think the way that I characterize it, we were talking about this a little earlier, is a little bit of it is art and a little bit of it is science, right? So let's talk about the process. What's the art and what's the science?
Right. So the science is, you know, it's the procedure and the steps that you take to come up with that final overpayment number. And the art of it is the negotiation where you have, as you said, there's a solid number at the end of an investigation, but you're not always going to recover that number. So there's got to be some negotiation, some back and forth. And that depends on a number of factors, but that's the art of it is if you have an overpayment of X amount of dollars, you want to get, you know, as close to that as possible, but there's going to be some negotiation. The other art part of it is, In addition to the recovery or the ROI, is you want to have some type of corrective action to prevent this, you know, future overpayments or recidivism, for lack of a better word. So getting some of the money back is half of it, and then avoiding to be in the same situation, you know, 6 months down the road is the other half of it. Equally probably as important. So the investigation, as you kind of alluded to, it has to be well documented. The denial rationale has to be solid. You have to have links to the regulations that are being referred to come up with that overpayment amount. That's not only important for the negotiations, but also again for that corrective action plan or that education piece of it, so that they know what they've done wrong, how they billed it incorrectly, and they can move forward and not have this, you know, another investigation 6 months from now. The other part of it is that money that is the overpayment is money that realistically should not have been paid. So it's not like we're asking for money back that, you know, they're saying this is money that I billed correctly. There's a couple different angles on this. It could be where, you know, were services not rendered, or was it just questionable, incorrectly billed? So that you would take into consideration as well. If it was, you think that the services weren't rendered, you might push more towards, I want 100% of that back because it was paid in error. Or if it was just documentation errors where the services were rendered, but they were incorrectly billed, incorrectly documented, you know, then you may be more willing to go for pennies on the dollar because it's more of a billing error.
That's actually a great point, because what you're really talking about are kind of grades of malfeasance, for lack of a better term, right? So if it's a case in which it's a coding discrepancy where the provider billed for a 4, but it's a 3, or the provider billed for one thing, but did another, and, you know, maybe there's a delta in the reimbursement versus a service is not rendered. So part of that thought process of the art and the science is sort of how bad is the FWA or compliance related issue, right? That's got to be probably one of your starting points, I would presume.
Right. Exactly. And if it is, that's part of the negotiation too, where the provider is going to basically plead their case. And if it is, you know, oh, we didn't follow the documentation requirements, but the quality healthcare service was provided, we're going to be more, I guess, lenient in what we're going to require them to pay back. You had mentioned a little bit about the extrapolation of a SVRS versus a probe sample, so I won't go into that too much, but that's something to bring up to them, especially if you're just doing a probe sample and they're giving you pushback on what they should pay back. You can just kind of educate them on, look, we're talking about, just for example, maybe 25 claims and X dollar amount as being overpaid, whereas if we extrapolate that to the whole universe, it's going to be multiples of that you're going to have to pay. So that's another I guess technique in doing the negotiation, where you just kind of tell them, look, we're looking at a very small piece of the pie here. We could go back and do an extrapolation, and the overpayment would be exponentially larger.
Right. And what about the premise of, for example, if you did a probe sample of 30 records and those 30 records all came up with an error rate of 100%, and it was kind of a higher end related problem, right? Not like an upcoding of one level, it's a service is not rendered, misrepresentation. It's something that's a little bit more, a little bit more meat on the bones, so to speak. Would that be a factor? You know, you're saying to the provider, hey, you know, we did a review of 30 records for this code, and we identified that you didn't provide, there's no documentation to say you did the service on these 30 records. The overpayment for these is whatever, $1,000, make up a number. And if they give you pushback, you said, you know what, we could resolve this right now and move on, maybe come up with a corrective action plan or something like that. But, you know, the next step would be a statistically valid random sample where, you know, these 30 records were problematic. So there is yeah, in that negotiation, you can take a harder stance on some things, right? And that's not inappropriate.
Right. And you should have that number available. You should have that in your back pocket, where if they're going to push back on the the repayment of the probe sample amount, you can say, look, this was a, you say 100%, but even if it was a 94% overpayment ratio, you should have that number in your back pocket and say, look, if we were going to extrapolate this, your overpayment would go from $1,000 to, you know, 400,000 or whatever that number is. So that should be in your back pocket. So that would encourage them to pay the probe sample overpayment and take the corrective action and try not be in the same position down the road. The other kind of bargaining chip, I guess, for within the negotiations is the repayment plan. Basically, they can, you know, you can say, look, you can, the overpayment is, say it's $10,000, you can write a check today and we resolve this. Or if it's, a lot of times we'll hear from the provider that, look, this overpayment's really gonna, we won't be able to make payroll, it's gonna really affect our ability to give these services. A lot of times they'll say, look, we're the only, for example, behavioral health, we're the only provider in the area. If we have to pay this back, we might have to close down, there won't be services available, all these different reasons, some very legit and some maybe just trying to not have to pay the money back. But basically give them a couple options. They can write a check to resolve it and move on if they're able to do that. If not, and the check could be negotiable as well. If it's $10,000, if, and going back again, if the services were provided and it was more of a billing documentation error, maybe if it's $10,000, we say, look, let's write a check for $7,500 or whatever to make it go away. Or you can do a payment plan, you know, whatever the overpayment is, cut it up into 12 equal payments paid over a year. The other option, especially if they're really not willing to negotiate, is look, these are claims that were overpaid, should not have been paid, so we will offset them from future claims, which we can, in most cases, we can do pretty easily. But it can be very problematic for the provider if you start pulling money. It messes with their books, and usually they don't want to do that. So that's another area where you can say, look, we can offset this if we have to, but, you know, we don't want to mess up your whole billing system. So let's either write it, come to a mutually right. agreeable amount that you can write a check for, or we'll do a payment plan, or we'll have to do the offset.
Right.
And I think it's important too, to, you know, to have that educational element to it where they know what they've done incorrectly, or they didn't document sufficiently or whatever, and basically tell them that, you know, we'll circle back in 6 months or a year to make sure that you're not doing the same thing. And if you are, then we can say, look, we've educated you on this, you know how it's supposed to be billed, you're still doing it the other way, so this you know, might tend to be more of a referral to law enforcement, because now you have that kind of that element of knowledge on the way it's supposed to be done right, and you're still not doing it. So it can turn from just repaying the overpayment to you've been educated, you're still doing the same thing. So now it's a referral for possible criminal right. investigation.
Right. For your right. For the repeaters or whatever yeah. it is. So Matt, that gets to, by the way, welcome back, Matt. We appreciate you going on during commercial break, you stepping away. So, you know, it kind of then gets to the point. There's kind of two pieces. First of all, let's talk about, when you're doing that negotiation, does it make sense to have the closers, right? We're talking about, you know, for those of you that are movie buffs, the Glengarry, Glenn Ross, ABC, always be closing, right? And so do you have people that are on the team who the investigator does their investigation, the provider has expressed an interest in resolving it, do you then pass that case off to someone whose job is really their primary role is negotiating settlements, because then you get people who become really conversant in the process. They become really expert in the analysis of that process. Or do you let individual investigators do it? And then, you know, you've got to make sure that everybody is well trained on, you know, here's our ceiling, here's our floor, and here's where we want to be. What becomes the, obviously, the smaller the plan, the greater the challenge of being able to bifurcate roles and things of that sort. But does one have an advantage over another?
As an investigator, I want to close it out. I want to do it myself. I know the facts of the case. I know the ins and outs of the data. I know the provider's history. I know all of that stuff because I've lived the case for the past 3 months, 4 months, whatever it might be. So there's an institutional knowledge advantage there, as well as for an investigator, the motivation of I'm bringing this thing to closure. Other side of the coin, you bring in a negotiator that's skilled in the art of negotiation. The investigator's got the science, the negotiator's got the art. That negotiator can look at the facts, can look at the PI history of the provider, can look at whether it was services not rendered or documentation, take a look at the age of the claims and things like that, and take all of that into account when they do the negotiation. And they have the know-how as to how to broach those subjects and get the provider on this, almost not on the same side, but with the same goal of resolving this thing rather than it being confrontational. And, you know, one of the things I tell my investigators, we don't have the specialized negotiator, is these people aren't the Lindbergh kidnappers. Don't go in there thinking you've got to throw the book at them and treat them badly and make this thing confrontational. And that's something an investigator may do because they've built this thing up. They've probably talked to some patients. Maybe there was, you know, ill will there and things like that. But you've got to have the mindset of what is the goal of a negotiation? It's to settle it. The negotiator is probably in a better place for that type of mindset than the investigator that's lived the case. So there's,
right.
I think that's the overall benefit of it. The problem, as you said, is resources. Do we have the resources to actually have that type of specialist to, you know, let's call in the lefty and bring him in for the ninth inning close?
Are you also, when you have a, excuse me, when you have like a consolidated negotiator, are you then affording yourself the ability to have a consistency that you may not have through individualized settlements? Not that there needs to necessarily be consistency, but, you know, as the person who does these settlement negotiations, if you know, hey, this is the fifth E&M upcoding case we've worked on, we've settled the other four for 75% on the dollar, let's stay with that consistency to treat providers the same way.
Yeah, as long as the facts are similar, yeah, there has to be that type of consistency. It has to be consistency in the approach and what factors you take into account when trying to settle something, as well as in what are the framework within the settlement's going to take place. Is it 50% of the dollars, 100, and you have precedents there that you should be using to also be a guideline for any type of negotiations. And having one person do that is a huge advantage.
Right. Well, I would say at the very minimum, even if you've got within your unit a team of people that are all doing the negotiations, it may not be a bad idea to ultimately have some sort of a tracking mechanism so that you can understand, for example, this provider, here was the allegation, the resolution, this was the overpayment amount, this is the negotiated amount, percentage of total, right? So that if I'm looking at a case, I can go back and I could say, oh, Wade worked on an E&M upcoding case. He settled his for 80%, you know, like just so that you have a level of consistency when it's not within those. So the last piece, Matt, as we kind of wrap this up, is the fallout post-settlement, right? Because providers are often going to say, all right, now that I've written you the check, like, you know, are we back to square one? So it's not, you know, fallout, not really maybe the best term, but sort of after the provider has resolved their matter, you know, is the case is closed, but is anything involving the provider? What becomes the follow-up?
Are they still on the radar? That's a lot of their questions. Is now that I've paid this, is the plan going to monitor me now more closely because I've done this? And the answer is probably yes. I mean, there is an instance now. You're not a first time, you're a first time offender. So there needs to be something in place, whether that be education, a corrective action plan, for the OIG, a CIA, to make sure that they're doing things the right way. At the UPIC, we did 6-month lookbacks. And we tell the providers, you know, and some of the providers even ask us to do that when they say they've made these corrective actions, is to look at us in 6 months, see if the billing has changed. And so we do that. So there's a continuum of post-settlement remedies that can be done all the way to prepay, you know, put them immediately on a prepay if it is one of those 100% services not rendered. You know, they haven't taken any type of corrective actions that you know of. You know, put them on prepay for a while, see what happens. So there are ramifications beyond the writing of the check or the payment plan that's put in place or the offset, whatever it might be, that to make sure that the provider is going to be compliant. And as Wade pointed out earlier, I didn't miss that part. Having that on the record, you know, allows for that knowledge and intent factor to be met if they don't change their behavior.
Right. Right.
So yeah, all of those things have to be made clear to the provider.
Yeah. You know, so, I mean, you know, we, when we talk to a lot of our SIU teams, that we do the consulting part or the advisory part, this comes up constantly in conversations. And I think, you know, part of where the general public sometimes there's a little bit of confusion is, you know, they see a case where there's an alleged multi-million-dollar fraud scheme, and then, you know, you see an indictment where someone gets indicted for $1 million and or whatever, or they resolve their case and it's for a lower amount of money ultimately. And I think that's, you know, part of that process. I think that it's very important for the public to understand and for people within and outside of the payment integrity world, that the dollar amounts that we identify as investigators as being what we consider to be the overpayment amount is likely not going to be the amount of money that we get back. I mean, I think that when you're looking, for example, when they do these healthcare fraud roundups, when the OIG does its work, and at the end of the year, when the OIG posts its multi-billion dollar recoveries, I think it's important to understand a couple of things. One, those numbers are not going to be the numbers that they actually that have been actually identified. Oftentimes the money just isn't there. The other thing too is, and I think this is a big challenge to get the answer, at least with respect to government stuff, is when the government is identifying $4 billion in recoveries or $5 billion, whatever that number is with the B, is that actual money in the door, or is it, or are those the numbers that have resulted in more on the criminal side, restitution orders and things of that sort? Because on the settlement side, that's money that's more likely coming in the door because of the agreements and what have you. So you have to take some of those amounts with a grain of salt. But, you know, I think the other piece of it is that when we see, and this is an ROI issue, if we were able to recover 100% of an identified overpayment in the SIU, ROIs would be insane because we would be recovering on a dollar for dollar basis. And that's just always the challenge to do that. And some of that negotiation is really, particularly if you have a provider group that has a very large patient base that comes from your plan, the provider abrasion piece it's a real thing that you have to consider as part of that. You know, it ultimately becomes a very large social experiment, right? It's we want every dollar. You know, when I was at the OIG, I would always say, if someone stole a dollar from the Medicare program, I wanted $2 back, right? I mean, that's just kind of the way it was. And in the context of the government, it's a little bit different because you can either settle it or you can fight it, and you're fighting against the government, right? You want to just resolve it and move on. In the SIU space, there's this whole back and forth that goes on, and there has to be a balance between recovering that money and continuing to keep the provider within the network to keep the patient population where they are and for continuity of care and all these other collateral things that are part of it. So the settlement negotiation piece is the thing that I think we get asked a lot about. We do a lot of training on it. There is a lot of, it's a lot more art than science. And I think that's where people need to always understand that. The science is, what's the audit say? And if the audit is not being disputed, particularly if it's a service is not rendered, then it's really more about is the dollar amount that we're going to get back something that we can all live with and resolve? And is it going to be a one-time payment? Is it going to be an installment payment, or, you know, what have you? So it's tough. And I think the biggest challenge is that a lot of the plans will come out and a lot of the investigators will say, well, you know, could we get some written guidance And I think that's the biggest challenge, is that there comes a point where you can't put things in writing because things are fluid. Things become kind of a case-by-case basis. And they're really, while there may be a kind of a checklist of operational things that you do, every case is different and every case is going to require a nuance and some different aspect that you're going to have to look at. So, just stay vigilant in training. Make sure you're up to date on whatever your administrative policies might be on overpayments and collections. And, some plans may say, we're not going to negotiate for more than a 12-month payment term. We're not going to negotiate for less than 60% or 70%. You have to know these things, and that's going to help with get you where you want to go. So it's a very interesting topic, and I think that there's no wrong answers. It's just going to be about what each individual plan's level of tolerance is and what their thresholds are and what they're expecting. So I don't think we have all the answers, and I think this is one area where I think you don't really have a course of action that you could definitively take. So keep on keeping on. We're always here to help you. And Matt and Wade, I know for you guys are dealing with this on a daily basis, so it's good to get your insights on this, and I appreciate you spending the time on that. So, as always, we appreciate everybody taking their time to enjoy our pontification and our stories and our tales of woe. I'll be reporting back next week on how the Springsteen movie actually turned out. And as always, join us for our weekly podcast. Get it in the newsletter. Get it on LinkedIn. Our LinkedIn lives for the next few months. We've got a number of them in the books ready to go. And so we look forward to enjoying those interactions with you. And until next time, we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable. Take care, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.